This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFK. If you're not already a member, consider joining with us and keep free speech alive.
I'm Michael Slate, and this is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. And we have a jam-packed show today. It's been tinkered together, and it's going to all lead somewhere, and in the end, you're going to want to jump up and run out and do something. So I think actually I'll let you know that first, at the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Sarah Santillas, who's a lecturer at Cal State Channel Islands, about the role of complacency in the carrying out of torture, the role of denial in the carrying out of torture. And before that, we'll talk to Ray McGovern. And Ray will be talking about the latest Senate report about the war criminals in the Bush regime who signed off on torture and the danger of that being followed up under the Obama regime. Before that, we'll talk with Andy Worthington, who's the author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. It's the only book that tells the story about Guantanamo. And we'll be talking with him about a particular case in Guantanamo. But before all that, I'm really pleased to welcome Carl Dix, a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And I wanted Carl to come on to do a commentary. I was initially going to interview him, and I read this piece again that he did in Revolution newspaper. And it is it's just a remarkable piece. And it's a piece that I think that the listeners of KPFK, which is actually, just to remind people, this is 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. But the point is, the idea of having Carl read this is that it's just a very compelling piece. And I thought it'd be really good to put this out there. And we can talk about it later. You know, we can actually have Carl back on and talk about this. But I think actually people need to hear this piece. So here's Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party with a piece that he wrote in Revolution newspaper called Don't Be a Buffalo Soldier. Carl, welcome to the show and take it away.
Thanks for letting me go on the air, Michael. Talk to the people out in L.A. and beyond. So here's my commentary. Don't be a Buffalo Soldier. During the Civil War, black soldiers were allowed to enlist in the Union Army. After that war, most left the Army, but some stayed. These soldiers were sent west to fight and kill the Native American Indians who were defending their lands against the government and the white settlers. The Indians called these soldiers Buffalo Soldiers. Buffalo Soldiers. Oppressed people given guns and sent out to kill other oppressed people. An old and shameful story that some people somehow take pride in. Now that story and that call is being revived. Barack Obama is going to the White House, the first black president, and he's calling for a new spirit of service to America. Well, I got a question, especially for black youth. Are you going to sign up to fight America's wars now? When Bush was talking about staying the course in Iraq till victory is achieved, most of you all weren't buying it. But now your chests swell with pride when you think of Obama becoming the commander-in-chief of the free world. Some of you all are thinking maybe you would fight for an America that has Obama in charge. Don't do it. The nature of these wars hasn't changed. They still come down to raining death and destruction on people who haven't done a damn thing to deserve that kind of brutality. Is having a black commander-in-chief enough to get you to enlist in America's wars for empire? To kill people and maybe die yourself, trying to keep America's stranglehold on the world in effect? Or are you going to stand with people around the world in opposition to these wars? Are you going to buy the poison Obama is selling and think and act like an American? Or are you going to start thinking about what humanity needs? You all aren't the first generation to face this question. Back in the 1960s, the U.S. sent hundreds of thousands of young men to Vietnam to kill people and maybe get killed themselves, to serve the U.S. empire in trying to drown the Vietnamese people's liberation struggle in blood. They tried to send me over there, but thanks to the powerful movement of resistance to that war and what I learned from GIs who had gone to Vietnam, I refused to go and kill people in another land. I had more in common with the Vietnamese than with the people who ran this country. And with all the hell black people were catching in the U.S., I felt my fight was here. I got sent to Leavenworth Military Penitentiary for this crime. Other GIs refused to go out and fight the enemy in Vietnam or resisted in other ways. and many who did go came back to the U.S. and got involved in resistance against the crimes of the system. Some of them joined the Black Panther Party and promoted solidarity with the struggle of the Vietnamese people. I became a revolutionary communist back then, and I've been on that tip ever since. Some things are different today. The U.S. is going against a different kind of enemy, Islamic fundamentalists, who don't represent anything good. And there isn't a powerful movement in opposition to these wars at the moment. But one thing is the same. These are wars for empire. They're going to send you to murder people at wedding parties in Afghanistan, terrorize children in their homes in Iraq, and run the U.S.'s torture chambers. No one should join up to fight or give support to these wars. Bombs dropped on villages in Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan by U.S. warplanes won't be any less destructive if Obama is the commander-in-chief of the pilot dropping them. Israeli cluster bombs spread in Palestinian villages and refugee camps won't kill any fewer children if Obama is authorizing the military assistance instead of Bush. Threats to attack Iran won't be any less warmongering if they are uttered by Barack Obama instead of George Bush. So again, I ask you, are you going to approach these wars thinking like an American? Are you going to follow the example of the Buffalo Soldiers? They were black cavalry units formed in 1866, made up of former slaves who had fought in the Union Army in the Civil War. They were sent off to fight in the murderous and genocidal Indian Wars, driving the native inhabitants off their lands to make way for the expansion of America from sea to shining sea. And while the Buffalo Soldiers were fighting the native inhabitants for America, black people in the southern U.S. were catching hell from the Ku Klux Klan and mob violence. Later, the Buffalo Soldiers were sent by the U.S. to fight Mexican revolutionaries like Pancho Villa. Some people think the legacy of the Buffalo Soldiers is something to be proud of. Colin Powell kept the Buffalo Soldier statue on his desk when he was a top official during both of the Bush presidencies. Colin Powell, who tried to cover up the My Lai massacre during the Vietnam War, who was a major architect of the first Gulf War, and who went to the UN and lied through his teeth to justify the invasion of Iraq in 2003. This man finds the Buffalo Soldiers inspiring. He called them the wind beneath my wings, and especially cited their loyalty. Well, theirs is a shameful legacy, and it's no wonder that a war criminal like Colin Powell is inspired by it. If you follow in the footsteps of the Buffalo Soldiers, you will be called on to do just like they did. Commit horrible acts against people who have done nothing to you, and you will do it in the service of a system that has carried out terrible crimes, including against the masses of African-American people. And you may end up giving up the only life you have in service of that foul system. Don't do it. Don't sign up for America's wars under the leadership of Commander-in-Chief Barack Obama and carry forward the legacy of the Buffalo Soldiers. Instead, get with a cause that's in the interest of humanity, a cause that's something worth fighting for, making revolution to wipe imperialism off the face of the earth.
Carl, thank you very much for that. I think it's something, you know, I was thinking back, but when we, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time. I'm going to have you back to maybe dig into some of the questions that are posed there. But I was thinking about, as you were reading, I was thinking about the night after the election out here in L.A. when they showed on the nightly news, they showed a scene down at Locke High School where a lot of the black kids who have been, you know, just thrown away in the whole educational system, the whole society, suddenly were coming in and were coming to school with Barack Obama carved into the back of their heads and then talking about how they were going to join ROTC to give them a life worth fighting for and how this was inspired by Barack Obama and the future he held out. And I think your commentary really puts things in. Are you going to be a fighter for this barbarous empire? Or are you going to be a fighter for the emancipation of humanity? That's the choice that these youth are facing. And Carl, thank you very much for presenting this, man.
All right, thank you, Michael.
All right, we'll have you back soon again, man, to talk about all this. That was Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party. You can read his and get copies of his commentary in Revolution Newspaper, and you can go to revcom.us and pick it up there, and or pick up the newspaper wherever you see it. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Andy Worthington about Guantanamo. Welcome back. I'm Michael Slate, and this is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. And that piece that you're listening to is very fitting for this next segment. It's The Gates of Hell from David Murray, and the album is Death of a Sideman. And joining us now is Andy Worthington. He's a British historian and the author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, which is published by Pluto Press, and has the distinction of being the only book to tell the stories of all the prisoners of Guantanamo, including those that we just don't hear that much about. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, hi, Michael. Good to be here.
Good. Well, let's jump right into it, because you had a recent article that I came across in Counterpunch that talked about this question of what will happen. I mean, there's this question posed for everybody about Obama talking about, we're going to close down Guantanamo, there's going to be the end of this, you know, and whether he does it or not, I mean, which is still, I imagine, still very much a big question within this regime. But, you know, the whole point of there are prisoners there that, one, there are prisoners who never should have been there, there are prisoners that they won't release, and there's prisoners that we don't even know anything about. And you wrote about a particular case, which I found very, very moving. Can you tell, and I don't know if I will mispronounce the name, but it was the Faisalabad 16?
Yeah.
Okay, can you tell us about that?
Well, Faisalabad is this, city in Pakistan where Abu Zubaydah was captured. Now, he's a kind of central figure in the war on terror, really, because he was the facilitator for a training camp, but was regarded by the CIA and by senior figures in the administration as a very senior figure in al-Qaeda. And he was subjected to waterboarding after his capture in March when he was taken to Thailand to a secret CIA prison. And in fact, there's just an article that's just come out today in Vanity Fair online by the British journalist David Rose, looking in detail about Zubaydah and the conflict between the CIA and the FBI about his significance, that he really wasn't a major figure. And yet they tortured him, and that as a result, they've spent the years since running around following all these false leads. Not only has this led to the torture of other people, but, he didn't have the information. They just tortured nonsense out of him and followed it up as though it was, major revelations.
Well, this man was actually certifiably sick, right? I mean, he was actually had mental illness.
Well, this is Dan Coleman's explanation. He's the former CIA, FBI operative, a man who worked on terrorism cases before 9/11 without resorting to torture. And he got to look through his diaries and said that, there was nothing of any relevance in there because he knew nothing about anything. What it did reveal was that he was writing his diary in three different personalities and that he clearly had mental health issues. An absolutely extraordinary story, but the thing about Faisalabad that you are asking me to demonstrate some of the stories of, you know, who are some of the mass of these people in Guantanamo that nobody ever hears about, is that on the night that this raid took place and Zubaydah and some other prisoners were captured, another guest house across town was raided, and the people who were seized from that place were a bunch of students, basically. Now, the tenuous connection with this place seems to be that it may have had some involvement with Zubaydah. He may have used it as a place where every now and then he, you know, put people up in. It certainly wasn't people who had anything to do with him who were guests in his own house. And these guys are still languishing there. Now, most of them were kind of, you know, between 18 and early 20s when they were seized. Some of them went for medical treatment. About half of these 16 were studying at a university, which was near to where the guest house was. And the administration has never come up with any significant allegations against them. There are no allegations against them of being involved in training camps or fighting with the Taliban or any significant links with al-Qaeda whatsoever. Just this tenuous connection with Zubaydah. And these guys themselves are just still sitting there, you know, nearly 7 years after they were captured. And some of them, when they were interviewed at Guantanamo, said, look, when we were taken in, the people who were talking to us said, we know that you're nobody. You know, we're sure you'll be going home soon. So, you know, what's going on? They're still there.
Well, you know, now, do these people have any relation to these ghost prisoners that people always talk about?
No, these are just, you know, just some of the standard prisoners in Guantanamo that nobody really hears about. And, you know, since Barack Obama got in and has pledged to close Guantanamo, now suddenly everybody's taking more of an interest. And, you know, what's worrying me is that the Weekly Standard, for example, a few weeks ago, had obviously spent some time going through the allegations against the prisoners, but had basically taken every allegation the government came up with at face value. Now, the problem with this is that we know, you know, from the evidence, let's say in particular, a great example is Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Abraham, who's a U.S. veteran of intelligence who worked on the tribunals at Guantanamo, which were responsible for putting the evidence together to prove that they really had captured enemy combatants who could be held without charge or trial. And he, you know, he's produced several long statements demonstrating that there was no access to any serious evidence against the majority of the prisoners held at Guantanamo. To the best of his knowledge, there really was very little evidence, and that backs up, you know, what the first commander of Guantanamo said shortly after the prison opened, when he said, he basically admitted, we don't really know who we've got here. So most of the allegations against the prisoners have come from the prisoners themselves, from confessions, or from confessions made by other prisoners. Now, what we know about the conditions in which prisoners were held is that these were generally obtained through one of two methods. The first of those is torture, or if it doesn't rise to the level of torture, it's coercion. All the enhanced interrogation techniques which were introduced and which were used on so many people. And the other way of gaining false confessions is to offer better treatment to prisoners. Now, you know, you offer somebody better treatment in their cells. You offer them food. You offer them treats.
I think we may have just lost Andrew for a minute. We'll get him back in just a moment. I'll take this minute to tell you that we're talking with Andrew Worthington, a British historian and the author of one of the best books on Guantanamo I've seen, in terms of really bringing the stories of all of the prisoners of Guantanamo to light. And the book is this Guantanamo Files, the stories of 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, which is published by Pluto Press. And it's the only book to tell the stories of all the prisoners in Guantanamo. His work, actually Andrew's work, dealing with the situation of all these prisoners in Guantanamo. Most of the fact, you know, and talking with Andrew, the few times I've had him on the show, it's always stunned me to see how many, you know, look, there are so many people in Guantanamo that people have no idea what's going on with them. Andrew, welcome back.
Hello. I don't know what happened there.
Well, I won't posit a guess, but anyway. So you were talking about, you know, do you remember where you were at?
I do, yeah.
Go ahead. Continue then.
Well, I don't quite know where we cut off, but I think I've just been saying that a lot of the confessions that the supposed evidence is based on were produced through torture and coercion, and that others were produced through bribing prisoners by offering them better treatment in Guantanamo, and that lawyers have established that there are several guys in Guantanamo who have lied against numerous other prisoners in an attempt to secure better treatment. And all these allegations are treated by the government as though they're facts. So when somebody like the Weekly Standard starts saying, oh, let's look at who's in Guantanamo and, you know, let's be careful here because these guys are really dangerous, the fact remains, as it has throughout, that the majority of the people in Guantanamo are not dangerous at all. Nobody's disputing that they got a handful of hard cases in there. But, you know, they did somehow manage to get a handful of people who were dangerous. But the majority of the prisoners simply aren't.
Well, now, tell me this. What, in your opinion, happens to the people like these 16 people? What happens to them if Guantanamo shuts down? Is there, you know, do you think that they'd be released? Do you think that some of them have just been, even though charges were dropped, they've just been sort of shuffled off into nowhere.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, I have to say that I'm reasonably confident that that a competent and objective board set up to look at the cases by the new administration would come to this similar conclusion that a large number of these people are not, there's no reliable evidence against them, and they're not actually accused of anything significant at all, you know, apart from the fact there are still completely innocent people in there who were caught because of false intelligence or because of bounty payments. There are other people who were low-level fighters with the Taliban in a civil war in Afghanistan that started before 9/11 and had nothing to do with it. You know, these guys shouldn't be held. Now, it's interesting because the habeas corpus reviews which are taking place at the moment, you know, which were instigated when the Supreme Court gave the prisoners constitutional habeas corpus rights in June. Three guys have just flown back to Bosnia yesterday. They've arrived today to be reunited with their families after 7 years. Because when their cases finally got up in front of a judge to review them last month, he looked at the government's evidence and said, you haven't got any evidence against these guys. You can't hold them. They were allegedly involved in a plot to blow up the U.S. embassy in Sarajevo. There was no plot. And the judge threw it out, and these guys have gone home. Now, this has already started happening with judges looking at the cases, because the government has relied for all this time upon nobody actually being able to challenge the reason that they're holding these men. So that's actually quite a good sign, and I'm not sure whether Obama might not want to keep some of that process going, because it's been reasonably well expedited by the judges as well.
Except the other thing you have to remember is that what's going to principally determine what Obama does is the fact that he's king of the empire.
Yes.
That's the defining parameter. Now, Andy, I want to ask you one thing, because we're very close on time here, but I wanted to give you a chance to actually talk about something you just wrote about, or I read about today. And that is you've written about it before, but the use of music is torture in Guantanamo, and a new movement against that. And I interviewed Tom Morello last week, and he was talking about how incensed Rage was to find out that their music was used as torture. And I wanted you to talk about it a little bit. We've got about 3 minutes. If you could just talk about that and the movement that's against it now.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's been used, you know, everywhere, really, with the Bush administration. They've used it in Iraq, they've used it in Afghanistan, they've used it in Guantanamo. They generally have used it as part of a package of techniques, the SEER techniques, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape. These are taught at U.S. military schools. They're based on what the Chinese communists used in the Korean War to torture captured American prisoners to get them to produce false confessions. That's the key bit, false confessions. They reverse engineered it to use it on prisoners captured in the war on terror, in Iraq, everywhere, with the intention of using something that had produced false confessions to produce real confessions. So the whole basis of it was wrong from the beginning. And this is all the stuff that we've heard about. This is the forced nudity, this is the sexual humiliation, the chaining, the isolation, all this stuff that we know about the kind of everyday torture, and music was part of it. And it's a hard one to get into a lot of people's heads, because they think it's funny. You know, you pick some music you don't like, you make the flippant comment, hey, if I had to hear that a lot, that would be torture. But under the circumstances in which people are held, you know, under a violent, threatening regime, with no knowledge of, you know, when they're going to get out of it, with apparently no sign of any kind of legal niceties being involved anywhere whatsoever, blasting music at people 24 hours a day just to keep them awake, to derange them, to soften them up for interrogation.
We've got 1 minute, Andrew, so can you talk about the Zero Decibels movement?
Yeah, sure. This is a movement started by the British legal action charity Reprieve, which is encouraging musicians who do genuinely care that what is supposed to be something entertaining and life-affirming is being used for exactly the opposite. And there is a website, zerodb.org. And it's about that, really. It's about encouraging people to get it, like Tom Morello did. And it was great to see this summer that Rage were turning up on stage wearing hoods and Guantanamo orange suits. And
exactly. Very inspiring, very important. Andrew, you know, we're going to have you back, and I'm sure we will, as the debate and the struggle around what's going to happen to the gates of hell.
Please do.
We'll have you back. And I do want to say one thing, though. When I have you back, we should talk about this a little bit, because I would not be so quick to jump at the point that the U.S. always says that they learn their torture from the Chinese, because, you know, the U.S. has needed no no one to tutor them in the techniques of torture. Look at what they did in the Philippines. And the Chinese, actually, I think that's part of that whole slander against the Chinese Revolution. So we can talk about that sometime in the future, but I just wanted, I felt obliged to say that because
that's
people just
heard.
Sort of make that assumption, you know. All right. All right, Andy, thank you very much for joining us.
All right.
And we'll have you back again soon, man. Take care.
Okay. Cheers.
Bye now. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Ray McGovern to talk about what's going on, this Senate report, and the possibility of, you know, what the response of the Obama regime may be in terms of the extension of torture. And we'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Michael Slate, and that is Fela Kuti with Mr. Follow Follow, which I thought was somewhat appropriate for this next conversation. And I want to remind you, you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara. And we're joined now by Ray McGovern, who was a CIA analyst for 27 years from the Kennedy administration through the first Bush. And we're going to be talking about the danger of torture continuing under the Obama administration. But also, I wanted to, because of this recent report that came out that sort of really shined a light, or they say it really shined a light, on all the top dogs who signed off on torture in the Bush regime, all the top war criminals. I wanted to get Ray's thoughts on that. Ray, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure.
Good to be back with you.
So what is your opinion of this Senate panel's report?
Well, I want to, first off, thank you so much for requiring me to read through this thing. I read through it about an hour ago. I had to wash my hands and take a shower.
Exactly how I felt.
Really so bad, Michael, you know, to see this in black and white, signed off on not only by Carl Levin, but by John McCain and the 12 Republicans on the Senate Armed Services Committee. This is quite an amazing document. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible indictment, first and foremost, of our Supreme Leader, President George W. Bush, because it doesn't shy away from saying in the very first paragraph that the whole thing was sort of enabled by the president's directive, and you can download this from the web, folks, February 7, 2002, in which he said, "We will not abide by Geneva. We will not worry about the War Crimes Act passed by a Republican-dominated Congress in 1996. We're going to treat the Taliban and al-Qaeda, quote, humanely and as appropriate and as consistent with military necessity, consistent with the Geneva Accords." Now, you know, that's a circle that can't be squared. Either you're going to follow the Geneva Accords or you're not. And if you're going to treat them as appropriate and as consistent with military necessity, you ain't following the law. And this is the law of the land, of course, since the Senate approved the Geneva Accords several times. And, of course, the whole Congress and the President himself signed off on the War Crimes Act of 1996. So this is quite amazing, and it's it just reeks with, you know, Lord Acton said, as many, many know, that power corrupts, and, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's what we have here. We have Cheney, Bush, seized total power. Thought that they could do anything they really wanted, this executive concept that they have, and now they're playing defense with a terrific offense, because 4 days after this report, Michael, what do we have? But we have Dick Cheney getting up before ABC and saying, right, I rooted for it, I greased the skids for torture, including waterboarding, and I think was totally appropriate. And I think was exactly the right thing to do. So,
what do you think's going on there, Ray? Because I was going to just bring that up. I mean, it was astounding to hear. You know, it was just chilling, and it just everything you had, you know, that you understood about war criminals coming just concentrated in my head and was just coming out of my mouth like at an unstoppable rate.
Yeah.
It was just amazing to hear this. You know.
Yeah. Well, I think that Cheney and Bush are counting on Barack Obama being the kind of wuss
that Nancy Pelosi, for example, is, that he will kind of shy away from doing the only appropriate thing for somebody who's got integrity, somebody who really is devoted to the rule of law, and that is to proceed against these war criminals, is what they are. And this memorandum from the Senate Armed Services Committee, as I say, unanimous, with 12 Republicans signing on to it, is that indictment. So what I think is happening here, I think Cheney is sort of throwing down the gauntlet, you know, and he's saying, okay, you guys, what are you going to do about it? You know, what are you going to do about it? And what he realizes is that he's got some of the key Democrats over the barrel. Now, what I mean by that, Nancy Pelosi knew about the torture, knew about the illegal surveillance, knew about many of the war crimes that have happened. She didn't say anything. As a matter of fact, she did sort of say, that sounds okay to me. And you know what, Michael? They've got it on tape.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the eavesdropping is all about. That's why, you know, that's what J. Edgar Hoover used to do, and that's why the Congress in 1978 passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which prohibited that kind of eavesdropping. So they've got Nancy Pelosi, and they've got Jay Rockefeller, and they've got all these top-level Democrats on tape as approving these things. And that's why there was no impeachment, and that's why Cheney is counting on them folding again. So it would really be up to Barack Obama to see what kind of a guy he is, whether he has integrity or he has guts, and whether he will insist on the prevailing of the rule of law.
All right, Ray, now you got me worried, okay? Because here's the thing. I mean, we can talk about this a little bit later, but, you know, one of the things with Obama, again, as I just said to Andrew Worthington, is that, you know, he is the king of the empire, and there is a point here where, I mean, here's a guy, you know, when the Military Commissions Act was passed, had the chance to, okay, maybe not defeat it, but as did all the other Democrats, no one stood up and said, no, I'm going to take a stand with humanity, and I'll filibuster, I'll do whatever I can, I'll hold conferences, I'll do whatever. This cannot be. And this was a stunning thing. I mean, I talked to a lot of people when people realized that for the first time in its history, this country was actually not doing torture, but proudly announcing that it was legal and it would do it.
Yeah.
You know, and this is, and to me, you know, we have to rely on the people themselves actually becoming conscious of what's going on here. I think this fight to actually get these guys indicted as war criminals is going to be a big part of this. This is a huge, you know, to me, it's just a huge thing. I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about this, though. This piece that you wrote, when you actually raised the question, will Obama buy torture light? And you talked about some of the Democrats in the Senate, and actually not just a small-time Democrat, but the guy who's the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, publicly stating that Obama should consider keeping some of this on.
Yeah, this is Sylvester Reyes, who's been chairman now for a year or two. He's come out with a little statement, actually made it to a reporter, that, you know, this is a really dangerous world, and we don't want, this is a direct quote, we don't want to be known for torturing people. At the same time, we don't want to limit our ability to get information that's vital and critical to our national security. Well, you know, Sylvester Reyes doesn't know diddly about getting information from interrogation. And there's one person, not only who knows, but has the guts to say it, and that is the head of Army Intelligence, who comes from a background in interrogation and, you know, a career in Army Intelligence. And what he says when he was announcing the creation of this new Army field manual for interrogation, he was asked, well, you know, what about torture? And he said, and I quote, no good intelligence is going to come from abusive practices. I think history tells us that. I think the empirical evidence of the last 5 years, hard years, tells us that, end quote. Now, he said that on the same day that the President of the United States, just 2 hours later, got up and applauded the successes, so-called, of torture, and asked the Congress to hold him harmless and all those that he directed to torture. And that's what we got in the Military Commissions Act, passed just before the new Congress was elected, which holds the president harmless for torture and anybody else that he directed to do that. Now, that's, you know, that's the kind of mafia-type operation that has prevailed here. And the thing that Americans don't know is that you don't get any good information from torture. I mean, you know, aside from the moral considerations, you know, I'm one that thinks that torture, just like rape or slavery, is intrinsically wrong, that you don't do that to people. But, you know, if you don't share that view, listen to the head of Army Intelligence, who says no good intelligence has ever been gotten from abusive interrogation techniques. I think he knows a lot better than Dick Cheney, and he knows certainly a lot better than the lawyers that we know now, and this latest report proves, justified the most abusive torture techniques.
You know, Ray, did you read the, there was an op-ed piece in the New York Times on December 13th, last Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And it was by this guy, I'm trying to remember his name now, Gerecht, Ruel Mark Gerecht.
Oh.
You know him?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. It was a pretty bone-chilling, you know, op-ed piece. I mean, he basically said, look, if we had gotten our hands on a senior member of Al-Qaeda before 9/11 and knew that an attack likely to kill thousands of Americans was imminent, wouldn't waterboarding or taking advantage of the skills of our Jordanian friends have been the sensible, moral thing to do with a holy warrior who didn't fear death but might have feared pain? And what that raises is the question of whatever they talk about, you know, not having torture here, not being able to deny that they're using torture or whatever, or, you know, not basically not having torture legally within the U.S., the continued use of rendition and the fact that they would have deniable torture then.
Yeah, well, Ruel Mark Gerecht is somebody I know, and he's off the scales here, but he's typical of the kind of myth that's propounded in our society that, you know, 24, Jack Bauer, mm-hmm. You know, it works. Well, it doesn't work, okay? And the ticking bomb scenario never happens. You're never sure that whoever you have knows where the bomb is in Times Square or those kinds of things. So the premise is contrived, and it's not, it doesn't have any relationship to the real world. And so it's not only a matter of moral considerations. It's a matter of, if you look at these scenarios that are contrived carefully, torture will never work because you can never be sure, A, that the guy knows, and B, that he's going to tell you the truth no matter what you do to him.
Mm-hmm. Well, now here's something that was actually, that someone has raised, which said that if the choice is between, and I think this is connected up with Gerecht, and it might have been a direct quote from him, but I'm not sure, so I won't say that. It says, if the choice is between non-deniable aggressive questioning conducted by Americans and deniable torturous techniques by foreigners acting on behalf of the U.S., it is almost certain that as President Obama will choose the latter. What do you think of that?
Well, I hope not. I hope, as I said before, that Obama has the kind of integrity that will lead him to be fully informed. You know, it doesn't matter if the Egyptians are torturing people or if we are. It's a feckless way to get reliable information in any case. Now, let me just add, you know, if it's not reliable information you want, but unreliable information, in other words, if you want Alibi to confess that he knew that Saddam was training Al-Qaeda in chemical and biological warfare, well, then torture is just great. It's just wonderful. Works like a charm. And when he confesses to the Egyptians, then you can tell the president, and the president can make a big speech about it and connect Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. It works beautifully, except you have to, you know, really have to dispose of the person, because in this case, Alibi went to the press just a couple of months later and said, hey, you know, I only said that because I wanted him to stop torturing me. Mm-hmm. But the damage was done. So the only use of torture that I can see is if you want unreliable information, if you want people to confess to things that they didn't really do. And as I say, in those cases, it works like a charm.
Wouldn't torture part of it, too, be used? I mean, I was just thinking about psychically how torture actually can be used internationally to actually present and to build up this whole, you know, caricature of an unchallengeable empire. You know, that if you dare to stand up and challenge us, then this is the kind of thing that you're going to run up against. You know, and it really does, I think it plays a tremendous effort in the mental oppression of people around the world.
You're right about that, and that's the second thing I usually adduce in to explain how it can be used. Take José Padilla, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, he was born and raised in New York City, as I was. He's an American citizen. He comes back, and they accuse him of all this stuff about dirty bombs and so forth. They put him in a brig in South Carolina, and they break the man. He's a broken person now. And he's an American citizen, but the president said, well, he's a unlawful combatant, and we're just going to keep him, and I have that power, and so forth. Well, that is kind of intimidating, and it certainly gives people who are younger than me or less or more worried about their situation than I am pause before they'll talk candidly about torture not being a good idea, and the president and the vice president and all those folks, you know, all those folks that were on the addressee list of the president's February 7, 2002 executive order saying we're going to disregard Geneva and just go ahead and treat them according to military necessity as appropriate. Okay. Now, what the Senate thing does is say that was the beginning. That set the terms of reference, and everything else was sort of justified ex post facto. But the thing that really gets me is that Condoleezza Rice has admitted that six key people, namely the people who were addressees on this list, she, who is the assistant to the President for National Security Affairs, Secretary of State Powell, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, the Ashcroft, the Attorney General, and the Vice President himself, and who else? Oh, of course, George Tenet, the head of the CIA. Those six met regularly at the White House and were treated to briefings by CIA operatives saying, well, now, this is how waterboarding works now. Do you think this would be appropriate for prisoner A, B, and C? Okay, what's the vote, you know? My goodness, you know, I call this the TTAC, the Torture Action Committee, or the Torture Techniques Approval Group, or whatever you call it. These are cabinet officers. These are people, including the vice president, ruling on which kind of torture technique would be appropriate. And all that is spelled out in chapter and verse in the Senate report.
Now, let me ask you one final question, Ray, and it's something you raised in your article. You said how the appointment of John McLaughlin and John Brennan as part of the Obama intelligence transition team. What do you think of that?
Yeah. Well, these are two people who were involved very much with George Tenet, who thought his duty was to do what the president said, and if the president needed, quote, intelligence, end quote, to justify a war, well, he would do it. And if he needed people to torture folks, well, that's how this all started. On the evening of 9/11, the president said, I don't care what the international lawyers say, we're going to kick some ass, okay? That's a direct quote. Richard Clark was there, and it's in his book, okay? So then what happens? The president says, now we're going to capture people in Afghanistan and then in Iraq. And George Tenet, you got some fellows that can, you know, take the gloves off and treat them as they need to be treated? And George says, well, you know, I'll go check. And he comes back 2 weeks later and says, yeah, I have about 11 guys left over from Vietnam. But, Mr. President, here, this is we need you to sign this permission. And it was then that the president turned to Gonzalez, who was his lawyer. Gonzalez turns to Addington, who's the lawyer for the vice president. They concoct this memorandum, dated 25 January, also on the web, and 13 days later, we get the authorization for torture. Now, that was really dumb. I mean, number one, for the president to take the advice of these mafia-type lawyers. Number two, it was really dumb to sign the thing. And number three, it was incredibly dumb for the White House to release that memorandum. They released it 2 years later, together with a whole bunch of other memoranda, which they thought would exculpate them for torture. And it turns out, here's the president's signature, and it's an inch and a half long. I've seen it in felt-tip pen, George Bush, and it's on the second page of this executive memorandum that's addressed to the vice president, secretary of state, secretary of defense, attorney general, chief of staff to the president, director of central intelligence, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And now we know from this report that General Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was one of the people that shut off the investigation into and torture techniques, shunned the top lawyers of the armed services, and enabled Don Rumsfeld to do what he did. And that, you know, I was just out at Kansas State University where where Myers is getting $100,000 a year just to give a lecture or two. And I was telling his students that he was an addressee on that memo and asking them if they knew what he did about it. Well, we know now. He batted away the lawyers from his door, and he gently said, "Yes, Mr. Rumsfeld, I'll do whatever you want. If you want me to keep quiet, I will." And that's how it was enabled.
Mm-hmm. All right, Ray, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
You're most welcome.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back, man. I'm sure this, as this unfolds, it's going to get deeper and deeper and grimier and grimier.
It is.
And we'll get in. Well, maybe we'll come back and have a discussion about how we can get people can actually get these war criminals to face charges of war crimes.
Yeah, if you could get Rule Mark Gerecht on with me, I'd love it.
That might be a good idea. No, I'll work on that for the new year, man.
Okay.
All right, Ray. Thanks a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm Michael Slayton. This is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. We've been talking with Ray McGovern, who works with the Tell the Word. He's also on the steering group of the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And he's a regular contributor to Counterpunch, and he's a contributor to the Imperial Crusades, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Yugoslavia, which is a book edited by Alexander Coburn and Jeffrey St. Clair from Counterpunch. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Sarah Centilles about the role of denial in facilitating torture. And someday you'll see that I'll get a chance to actually play that song a little bit longer than this, but I really don't want to miss a chance to talk with Sarah Centilles. And that is Who You Gonna Blame from the album Free and Fontella Bass. Joining us now is Sarah Centilles, and Sarah is the author of A Church of Her Own, What Happens When a Woman Takes the Pulpit, and Taught by America, A Story of a Struggle and Hope in Compton. She earned her doctorate in theology from Harvard and teaches at California State University, Channel Islands, and she teaches critical thinking. Sarah, welcome to the show. I'm so glad you teach critical thinking.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, let's jump right into this because I want you to have most of the opportunity to talk here. This point about if people see torture, the response to torture, and oftentimes people thinking that, you know, that if they're denying it, it's just a response. Let's talk about that.
Well, I've been thinking a lot about denial, partly in my work teaching critical thinking and encountering students who are full of power in the world but want to think that they are powerless or have been taught to believe that they're powerless. And I started thinking about denial in a way where people talk about denial as a response to something that's overwhelming. You know, if you learn about torture and there's just so much pain and it's so difficult to think about, that maybe denial is a natural way to respond to seeing another human being in pain. But then I started looking back at a book that's been very important to me called The Body in Pain, written by Elaine Scarry, that's a study of torture and war and human creativity. And she writes that torture happens in these three sequential steps. She says, first, a torturer inflicts pain. Second, the pain is objectified, or in other words, it's made visible to those not experiencing pain. And the third step of torture is that the torturer denies that another human being is in pain. It's not that the torturer doesn't know that that person is in pain, but the torturer reads that pain as a kind of power or as a symbol. So I started thinking that maybe denial isn't a response to torture, but it's a necessary part of torture, and that when we respond to, for example, the photographs from Abu Ghraib by denying that we're torturing, then we continue what happens in those interrogation rooms, that, in other words, our living rooms become the hard site at Abu Ghraib prison. So that's my idea about denial, that it's not a response to torture, but it's what allows torture to continue to happen. And whereas the torturer sees another person's pain as his own power, when we respond with denial, we read another person's pain as our own powerlessness. We think that there's nothing we can do to stop the torture, and that is how we participate in allowing it to occur.
In some ways, though, and I read something that when you participated recently in a program on torture sponsored by the ICUJP, it was at St. John's a few weeks back. And, you know, one of the things that you said there was that, you know, to me there was actually, it really made me think, because it made it much more than sort of just a sort of in the air kind of, you know, facilitating torture, allowing it to happen. You actually said that the people by denying torture, by having that kind of response to it, denial to it, either just denial in the sense of, like you said, when people reacted to the photos of Abu Ghraib or anything else, you know, the waterboarding, any of that, or even actually, quite frankly, the passage of the Military Commissions Act.
Hmm.
You know, when you think about that, and that all that allows the torture to dehumanize the victim, and also puts the people who take up that denial in the place of the torturer themselves, in a certain sense.
Yes, I think that that's true. I think that we like to pretend it has nothing to do with us, but my argument about denial is that it has everything to do with us. That we're actually standing in we might as well be standing in those interrogation rooms ourselves. I actually used the story of Abraham and Isaac to illustrate my point. This idea that Isaac thinks God is telling him to do violence to his son and takes Isaac up to the top of the mountain and raises the sword above his son. And it's only when he allows himself to both see his son and see the fact that he's about to kill his son that he can stop it. And if we don't admit that we're the ones holding that sword, if we don't let ourselves see the people that we're doing this to, we won't be able to work against torture.
All right, Sarah, and what was your reaction to Cheney this morning saying, "You're damn right I upheld torture, and I'm responsible for waterboarding"?
It's stunning. I think one of the things in my research, I wrote in my dissertation on the photographs from Abu Ghraib, and the thing that's most stunning to me is how out in the open all of this is. It's not hidden. I mean, you can find all the documents. It's always been clear to me that Cheney's been involved in this, Rumsfeld's been involved in this, Bush has been involved in this, and the fact that they say it right out and are willing to admit it, but still nothing happens to stop it, it kind of blows my mind.
All right, Sarah, I want to thank you very much. We're going to have you back. I'm going to plan on doing another show with you and Reverend Atkins to talk about the sort of recreating a little bit of the program you put down at St. John's. But we'll have to cut it short now. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on your show, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Definitely will. That was Sarah Santillis, who's the author of A Church of Her Own, What Happens When a Woman Takes the Pulpit, and America's Story, Taught by America, A Story of Struggle and Hope in Compton. And she's a teacher teaches critical thinking at Cal State University, Channel Islands, and she's been doing a lot around torture and the responsibility that complacency actually equals complicity. All right, we're going to go out now with Rescue Me, but I want to make a couple of announcements. I want to thank my board op G, my director, Christine Blasdale, and the show is produced and hosted by me, Michael Slate. And I want to thank all of my guests today. I also want to let you know that if you listen to this program today and you're sick and disgusted and you want to hear something else that's going to get you very angry, John Yoo is coming to Chapman University Law School. That's right, John Yoo, the author of the infamous torture memo, is coming to Chapman University Law School. Now, if you want to be part of talking with people about planning a fitting welcome for John Yoo next month in January, call World Can't Wait, 213-924-8571. Remember, John Yoo, the man who said that if it took crushing the testicles of a young boy to get his father to speak, that was fine. Okay, John Yoo coming to Chapman. World Can't Wait, 213-924-8571. You want to talk to me? You can. Michael Slate at redfuture.com. I'll be back again next week. Looking forward to talking to you then.